Today's episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast is brought to you by FreshBooks. To see how FreshBooks can save you time and boost your creativity, go to freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental in the How Did You Hear About It section. Hey everyone, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast. My name is Todd Henry. I'm the founder of Accidental Creative, also the author of several books, including The Accidental Creative, Die Empty, Louder Than Words, and the brand new book, Herding Tigers, Be the Leader That Creative People Need, which is all about how to create an environment in which creative teams thrive. And here on the show, we talk about you and your process and what it takes to be prolific, brilliant, and healthy every day as a create-on-demand professional. You know, most of us go to work and we solve problems every day. We have to design, write, create. We have to lead other people. And in so doing, there are a unique set of pressures that we face. And we need to learn strategies for dealing with those pressures and helping us bring our best work to the table. Today's show features one of my favorite guests and one of my favorite people, Peter Bregman. He's the author of a new book called Leading with Emotional Courage. And he's going to talk to us about what it means to show up with emotional courage every day at work, to bring your best, and to put yourself in a position where you are fully pouring yourself into the work you do and into the team that you lead. Before we dive into that, I want to let you know today's episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. So in my latest book, Herding Tigers, I talk about the five popular myths that exist about creative people, and they drive me crazy. One myth is that creatives lack business acumen. The truth is that creative people can be extremely business savvy, as you know. They just happen to solve problems differently. We think in more roundabout ways, often about problems, not in such a linear, strategic way. Well, nobody understands this more than FreshBooks. The proof is in the millions of creative professionals that have turned to FreshBooks cloud accounting to help them conquer their admin and paperwork. Oh, and by the way, I happen to be one of those creative pros. The first instant I started using FreshBooks, I understood exactly why it's such a perfect fit for creative pros. The interface is visual, it's really intuitive, and it's ridiculously easy to use. Sending a professional branded invoice takes about 30 seconds, even less in many cases. You can set yourself up to receive online payments with just two clicks, and the new proposals feature means that you can incorporate your project details, your scope of work, and a timeline as part of your estimate. So to get a feel for using FreshBooks, they're offering an unrestricted 30-day free trial to all listeners of the Accidental Creative Podcast, which means no credit card, which is incredibly rare. All you need to do is go to freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental in the How Did You Hear About It section. Once you start using FreshBooks, you will continue. It is brilliant. Freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental in the How Did You Hear About It section. We thank FreshBooks for sponsoring this episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast. Well, it's great to welcome back to the Accidental Creative Podcast, Peter Bregman. He is the author of a brand new book called Leading with Emotional Courage, How to Have Hard Conversations, Create Accountability, and Inspire Action on Your Most Important Work. I think that pretty well summarizes everything we have to do as leaders, right? It's a fantastic book, and it's going to be a great conversation. Peter, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast.
Thank you so much. It's so fun to be here with you again.
So you're one of my favorite thinkers on anything related to leadership. You have a fantastic podcast called the Bregman Leadership Podcast, correct? That's the correct name. Am I getting that right?
Or is that just that's the right name too. Fantastic. And I'm a huge fan of yours too.
Thank you. That's really kind. But for those who may not be familiar with your work, I've had you on the show before. So if you're not familiar, go back and listen to that. But could you just describe a little bit about what you do and kind of who you work with?
Sure. I work with CEOs and leadership teams in organizations. And we, you know, I was sort of thinking about this question the other day because it seems like such an obvious question. But I was on NPR and we had this whole show. And then Charlie Herman, who was the producer, said, great, everything was smooth. Now, just so that we have it, say your name and say what it is your company does. And we had to do like 12 takes as I was trying to figure out like how to describe. And he turned to me and he said, you know, this is the easy question. Like you've just done, you know, this whole interview. You should be able to figure this out. So I sort of thought about it because I don't know why it's so hard for me to describe what we do. But in the end, what it is, and I realize this is a strain through all of my work, is helping leaders create focus and follow through. And, you know, ultimately what we're trying to do is help people get massive traction on their most important work. And the way we do that is by helping them create focus and follow through. And that could be for an individual or it could be for an entire organization.
So focus and follow through. That's interesting because so follow through is the execution piece, obviously. Why focus on the front end?
Well, because what happens is if you don't have aligned, consistent focus of larger groups of people, what happens is you have everybody who's focusing on their own thing and they're following through on their own thing. So everyone's individually productive, but because they're moving in all sorts of different directions and there's not sort of a consistent, aligned, collective focus, what happens is the organization doesn't move anywhere while everyone individually is productive. And so the challenge is to get everybody moving in the same direction and then following through on the execution piece.
Oh, I love that. So the book is called Leading with Emotional Courage. I love that phrase, emotional courage. I wish I had thought of that phrase, actually. When I saw your title, I'm like, oh, that's so good. Let's talk about what that means, because I think people, if you say leading with courage, I think people say, okay, I've got that. I'm going to make bold decisions. I'm going to put my neck out. You know, we think of this sort of command and control kind of, you know, model when we think of courage, but that's not really what you're talking about. What does it mean to lead with emotional courage?
So if you think of anything hard that you do, and maybe to raise the bar, think of something you procrastinate on. And since we, you know, you work a lot with creatives, and I, you know, and we're both creative, right? We're both writers. Right. We're both kind of constantly putting our work out there. So, you know, think of like the blank page, or think of, you know, a difficult piece of work you've been having a hard time getting to, or a difficult decision that you're wanting to make, or a difficult conversation that you want to have, but you haven't had, you've sort of held off on having for whatever reason. Now think about the reason, right? Think about the reason we hold back. And if it's facing, you know, the blank page, it's not that we don't know how to do what we do. It's not that we don't have the skills. It's not that we don't have the time or the opportunity. So what is it that holds us back if it's not knowledge or capability or opportunity or time? And if you really think about it, it's none of those things. It's what you don't want to feel. So if I have to have a hard conversation with you, I might be worried that you might get defensive, that you might get angry, that I might get angry, that we might get disconnected, that we might have some conflict, that I might feel shame. I don't know what I might feel, but because I don't want to feel those things, not because I don't know how to have the conversation or I haven't had time, but because I don't want to feel those things, then I end up not following through on the work that's most important to me or the conversations that I most want to have.
Right.
And so emotional courage is the willingness to feel. It turns out that that's what underlies our willingness to act. Our ability to act courageously is built on the foundation of our willingness to feel courageously. And if we're willing to feel everything, the shame or the embarrassment or the failure or the, you know, uncertainty, the blank page, if we're willing to feel all of those things, we're going to feel it, then we can do anything. We can act through it. I had an interesting conversation with someone who I was saying that I really wanted to write fiction, but I was having a hard time sitting down. And she said, oh, that's interesting. Why do you think you're having a hard time sitting down and writing fiction? And I thought about it and I thought, you know, I'm a pretty accomplished nonfiction writer. And I've kind of put, this is my fourth book, and I feel like I know how to do that. But fiction has always fascinated me. I would love to be able to write fantasy and fiction, but I don't think I'm very good at it. I sit down and I write stuff, and then I look at what I've written and I think, oh, that's pretty poor. And I think I'm scared is why. I think I'm scared. Yeah. And so then the person said to me, well, that's so interesting. You think you should be able to write without being scared? And I thought that's just awesome, right? That's it. Yeah. That's emotional courage in a nutshell.
Yeah, isn't it frustrating when somebody asks you the question that gets right to the heart of the matter? Especially exactly. when you are the person who does that for other people, right?
Yeah, that's my question. Don't ask me that question. That's my question.
That happens to me all the time when I'm working with a team and somebody asks me something and I say, oh, that's not fair. I'm supposed to be asking you that, not vice versa. You know, it's interesting you say that the willingness to feel is the beginning of emotional courage and leading with emotional courage, because I've sort of had this thing I've been saying to people for a while that a lot of people would like to live with the perception of invulnerability than test their limits and realize they actually have some. It's easier to just live with the assumption that I'm invulnerable. I can do anything because I don't fail, rather than pushing out to the edge and realizing, no, I actually have limits to my competence and limits to my ability. And I think that applies to more than just leadership or business. I mean, that applies to, you know, working out, right? Like, I don't want to go work out because I don't like how it makes me feel when I'm not the most fit person in the room and I'm not able to get the reps in that I want or whatever it is. I think the willingness to feel is a great phrase to latch on to, especially for creative pros, because every day we're testing our limits.
Yeah, it's a great, you know, it's funny you do the workout example, because yesterday was one of those days. I mean, I work out every day and I'm usually feel pretty strong, but yesterday I didn't work out till the afternoon and I'd eaten too much and I started working out and it just felt awful. Like it just felt like my stomach was too, it just felt awful. Yeah. And I really, like 10 minutes in, I was like, I should just stop, right? And just skip this workout. And I've really felt that moment. And the amazing thing about building emotional courage is you see these moments differently, right? So then I can see that moment and I go, oh, so I don't want to feel like I'm working out and I ate too much. I don't want to be reminded that I just ate too much. I don't want to feel like I'm working out and I can't do what I could do beforehand. And I know if I was, you know, if I was working out in the morning, I would be stronger. So I should just do that. And actually being in shape means working out, and having emotional courage means working through those icky feeling moments to get to the other side. And when you do, you've not only built your physical muscle, but you've built your emotional muscle.
So let's talk about where that all begins. At the beginning of the book, the first element, as you describe it, is about building confidence. And, you know, I think one of the, I don't know if you see this, but I definitely see this when I talk to leaders. I think one of the common themes when you really peel back the onion is that a lot of people feel like everybody else has it figured out and they're the only one who doesn't have it figured out. And they just don't have the confidence that they need to be able to go out and to extend themselves and to be vulnerable with their team and to lead with emotional courage. So what are some of the elements of building confidence that we need to be focused on?
You know, your point is great. And I'm going to keep using my fiction writing, both because of who the audience is and also because it feels very real to me. You know, you don't need the confidence. When I mean confidence, I don't mean arrogance. I don't mean confidence as in, oh, I'm so great, I'm really confident. I mean confidence that rises above whether you're great or not great. I mean the kind of confidence that says, whether I'm great or not, I have significance. I matter. I believe in myself. I can do it. So I can write something and have it not be good, and that doesn't throw me. And I come back the next day and I write something again. Mm. And you know, it's that famous Ira Glass paragraph or quote that I'm sure you've heard or you know, but it was something to the effect of, you know, every great artist goes through years of what I'm about to describe, which is they get into it because they get into whatever creative endeavor they're in, whatever work you're in, you get into it because you have good taste,
yes,
right? And you're interested and you work hard and you're interested. But by definition, when you start, your stuff is just not that good. And so you, and your taste is good. So there's this huge gap between your taste and your output. And so, and that's very disheartening. And you know, all creatives go through years of living through that gap until they eventually close that gap and they begin to actually like their work. So it's very hard to stay steady and balanced and calm and grounded in the face of doing work you just don't think is very good. But that's the only way to get good. So yeah. Confidence in yourself is about really that sense of, I'm not going to lose myself by evaluating my own value and self-worth by the kind of work that I put out there. And I'm going to value myself independently of that. And I'm going to bring that self to every piece of work that I do. And that's hard to achieve.
It is. It's hard. And it's also difficult when so much of who you are is put into what you do, right? So your perspective, your worldview, your intuition, all of that is wrapped up in your work. It's not a nice, neat, clean thing, especially when you're doing creative. Like, listen, if I'm like you know, calling people from a service center. I mean, that's perfectly honorable work, but like if somebody hangs up on me, I'm not feeling like I have been personally rejected. It's like, that's probably going to happen 150 times a day. But when I spend a week or a month working on something that is very near to and dear to me, and I put it out there in the world and it's roundly rejected, it's a really difficult thing to parse who you are from what you make, don't you think?
Well, that's it. You know, your call center example is a very interesting example, Todd, because you know, if you ask people who work in a call center, my bet would be that if it's their first day and their first call got rejected, they probably wouldn't feel so good.
True. Right?
But the reason the call center example is so interesting is because they would get rejected 1,000 times a day. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest we do the same thing with our work, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, get rejected 1,000 times a day. And then suddenly the 1,001 time you realize, huh, it, you know, it may not be about me. It may just be like, this is how it operates. But the other thing that I would say is, so in other words, what I'm saying is get good at rejection and not losing yourself in it. But the other thing I would say is at the beginning, I don't think you need to show your work to anybody. I'll tell you something I'm doing with my fiction writing, which is my daughter, who's 16, who's an unbelievable fiction writer. And I realize I have a lot to learn from her, and I really love doing stuff with her. And so she and I have a writing date. Once a week, we sit on my bed and we write, and we have our laptops out and we spend an hour or two writing, and then we read our writing to each other and we enjoy it. And I love her writing. So I'm super supportive because she's awesome. And she's super sweet and super supportive with my writing. And I don't need the critique. I don't need to show it to, you know, I have friends who are really accomplished fiction writers, and they look at my stuff and they would say, you know, hey, this is great. I'm glad you did it. Now rip it up and start again. And right. I don't know that I like really want to hear that right now. I think what I want is my daughter to go, wow, I really want to know what happens next to, you know, your character.
Right.
And that's fine. Like, I don't need to be perfect right now. And I just, maybe I need that encouragement. So be thoughtful about who you're sharing your work with so you don't lose yourself in the midst of that criticism. And then as you build that muscle and you start writing and it becomes this habit, now you're writing every day and you know you won't get thrown if someone, you know, criticizes your writing, then show it to broader people.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that advice. And I think it's so valuable. You know, everyone wants to be the genius out of the gate who produces the stellar piece of work, and everybody says, where did you come from? You're so great, right? But the reality is, it is a lot of discovering yourself, discovering your aptitude, what you're good at. And this applies not only to making art, but to any, I think, career endeavor. I mean, it is going to be a long layering process, right? Of trying to figure out who you are. What it is that you contribute when you're at your best. One interesting thing I read in the book that kind of surprised me, frankly, I'd love for you to unpack it a little bit for us, is, you know, you talk about being, you know, there's a lot of talk about authenticity, the importance of authenticity and, you know, being yourself and all this, but you talk about the value of being inauthentic. That was really, it really struck me. So what do you mean by that?
You know, anytime we learn something, we're breaking some kind of habit. It might be an intellectual habit, a habit of thinking. It might be a habit of acting. But anytime you're learning to show up differently, to think differently, to do differently. And by the way, we have a hard time with that in our culture. It's why conservative listens to Fox and watch Fox and liberals listen to MSNBC or CNN. It's because we want, and it's the confirmation, like we want people to, you know, we want to listen to opinions that agree with us. We want to support ourselves. And if you're going to really go into anything with a willingness to be changed, right? And I'm a real strong believer in that. I go into every conversation. I do my best to go into every conversation, not with a desire to change you, but with an openness and a curiosity and a willingness to be changed. And if you do that, and then you're going to try on some new stuff, by definition, it's going to feel inauthentic. So for example, I'll give you a quick example. I was with a very close friend of mine who's been my ski coach. I teach skiing, and she's 10 years older than me, and she's been my ski coach since I was 10 and she was 20. And she now, you know, we both teach instructors, but she's, you know, she's an incredibly accomplished skier, was on the national demo team. And so she was teaching a bunch of instructors, and I said to her, "Hey, I want to tag along." And she said, "Okay, you could tag along. Just don't say anything because I really want to teach these guys stuff. And I, you already know the stuff, and I don't want you detracting from the experience that they're going to have." And I go, "All right, this will be interesting. I won't say anything." And so I didn't say anything. And I was silent, and I felt so incredibly exposed and vulnerable in my silence. I'm not someone who usually sits there silently. I'm a teacher, and so I didn't say a word. And I felt so exposed. I felt, first of all, it was totally inauthentic. It was very inauthentic for me to just sit there and listen and not say a word, literally not say a word for a couple hours. And second of all, I felt like everybody was looking at me and like, why is Peter not saying anything? Like,
oh,
that's weird, et cetera.
Yeah.
Like I had, it was such an uncomfortable place for me to be. And yet I was there the whole time. And then afterwards, as I talked to people, I realized that was all in my head. Nobody noticed. In fact, people enjoyed me in my silence, which might be a whole other thing for me to learn. But it felt totally inauthentic for me not to support what she was saying, to ask a question, to explore something. I was just, and it was a totally new behavior, and it felt so weird. But if we're going to learn something new, it means we're going to break out of a habit of something we've always done. And if we do that, it's going to feel weird. It's going to feel out of your norm. It's going to feel awkward, and it's going to feel inauthentic because it's not you. Because you is the old behavior. But the new behavior is new you, and you're learning you or exploring you or trying out you that's different, and that's going to feel inauthentic. And so we have to be willing to feel inauthentic if we're going to learn and change.
Oh, I love that. We've been talking to Peter Bregman. He's the author of the new book called Leading with Emotional Courage. Peter, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
It was such a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
And as always, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You'll get every episode as it's released. Or visit accidentalcreative.com/subscribe to get new episodes by email. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time.